This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have the story of a legendary female aviator and member of the Mercury 13, who was also the first female FAA inspector and the first female investigator for the NTSB. In the news, AerCap and GECAS plan to merge into the world's largest commercial aircraft leasing company. The Dassault Falcon 6S first flight was dedicated to Olivier Dassault, who just died in a helicopter accident. The FAA announced the 2021 GA Award winners. Southwest Airlines found Buzz Lightyear, and we look at some notable women in aviation. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 645 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's the guy who knows more about the Cirrus aircraft and the Klapmeyers. Well, maybe that's an overstatement. Hi, Max.
That's funny. Of course, the Klapmeyer brothers are the co-founders of Cirrus, and no, I don't claim to know nearly as much as they do, but thanks for the recommendation. And hey, the room looks pretty full here. We got a full house tonight. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, we have quite a crowd with us. We also have Airplane Geeks reporter-at-large Launchpad Marzari.
Greetings, everyone, within the sound of my voice in the air and at sea, from deep in the heart of.
Very good. Also with us is Rob Mark, senior editor of Flying Magazine, and he also publishes the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening, and thank you for doing that twice, Max, because I was tardy to the... I'm just a little off tonight, you know? I feel it. So please, bear with me.
Well, we think you're a little off also, but that's why we asked you to come on the show.
So much fun.
David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian, is off again this week. He's feeling a little under the weather, so he's hopefully he's in bed. And if he's not, that he's eating chicken soup. Well, our guest this episode is author Loretta Hall. She captured the memoir of the extraordinary female aviator Wally Funk. Now, just quickly, Wally Funk was the first female civilian flight instructor at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. She was the FAA's first female operations inspector and systems worthiness analyst program specialist. She was the first female NTSB accident investigator. She was one of the Mercury 13, who in 1961 passed the same physical exams as the male Mercury astronaut candidates. And she participated in a number of air races, winning the Pacific Air Race against 80 participating competitors in her Citabria. And there's a lot more, which we will see. Now, Loretta Hall, who is here with us, is a freelance writer and a nonfiction book author. She's a longtime space travel enthusiast. She's currently a certified space ambassador for the National Space Society. Loretta has written 8 books, including 5 on the history and future of space travel, one of which is the complete space buff's bucket list, 100 space things to do before you die. I have some questions about that. That sounds fascinating. But her newest book is Wally's memoir. It's Higher, Faster, Longer, My Life in Aviation and My Quest for Space Flight. And that's available on her website, wallyfly.com. Loretta, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you, Max. It's a pleasure to be here.
I really do love the idea of the space buff's bucket list.
Say that 10 times fast.
It's very difficult, isn't it? Is that a list that's for anybody in all ages?
Yep. It's how to participate in space exploration, in some cases from the comfort of your home, and in other cases, to go other places and do other things.
Now, have you been ticking off the 100 items yourself?
Mm-hmm. I think I'm up to 61 or 62, something like that.
Amazing. Very good.
When you came up with that list, Loretta, when you hit like 82. Did you ever worry that you wouldn't think of 18 more?
All the time.
Yeah, wouldn't that be that? That would just be the most unbelievable. I've got 100 things that I can only get to 98. Oh, God. Anyway, that's an amazing feat.
I did a lot of research and actually discovered some things I hadn't been aware of before. So it was really fun.
All right. Very good. Well, let's talk about Wally Funk and all those things that I mentioned, very earliest ATP ratings. I think she was the 68th woman to get an ATP rating. Female inspector for the FAA, the NTSB, and, of course, the Mercury 13. But she was also an outdoors woman. She was an expert marksman, which I think is interesting. And she even did some slalom and downhill ski racing. Loretta, what can you tell us about what drove the woman, Mary Wallace Funk? What drove her to develop this amazing life?
It's just something innate in her personality. She is one of the most positive people I've ever known. She just has a spirit of curiosity. And when something strikes her curiosity, she wants to go do it. And if she hits a roadblock, she has a favorite expression that she learned as a child. She grew up in Taos, New Mexico, in a community that included Native American Pueblo Indian tribe. And so from her Indian friends, she heard this expression that when you come up against something that basically you can't control and it prevents you from doing something, you throw it a fish. I'm not sure where that came from. If you like, maybe it was if you're, you know, in the woods and you're accosted by a bear, if you throw him a fish, he'll leave you alone. I don't know. That's just my guess. But that's the way she is. That's one of her favorite expressions. And when she hits a roadblock, throw it a fish and go on, find another way to do it.
Isn't that so true of all the people that really end up being successful, is that they all hit some of the same, sometimes more of the roadblocks than anybody else, but they just somehow hunker down and just steer around it.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I got interested in her story.
I'd like to start at the beginning and ask our listeners, as well as our correspondents with us, think back to what you were doing when you were 21. I was struggling through, you know, calculus to worry about graduation. And Wally was being an astronaut's candidate. You know, oh my God, you know, she was doing that when she was 21. Let's start there. Holy cow.
Well, especially in those days in the, you know, late 50s, early 60s, and there were roles for different genders generally. And of course, we've come quite a ways since then. Did she see that as an impediment or as a challenge, or was that just something that wasn't even on the top of her mind? How did she approach the fact that, you know, when you look at engineering and NASA and astronauts and all, that it was very definitely a man's world?
I don't think she looked at it as an impediment as such. She had her own objectives in mind. She knew what she wanted to do. And she just wanted to be able to do it. And she put herself in the positions of being able to do those sorts of things, even if she was in a gender minority. It wasn't to prove a point. It was just so she could do what she wanted to do.
And has she slowed down at all? I guess she's in her early 80s probably now. Does she still fly?
No. She's slowing down some, but she's still an amazing person.
Oh, sure. I mean, trying to take a rest from a life that...
It's hard for me to keep up with her. She walks fast. She just...
goes right by.
Well, let's see. When did the first astronaut... when was the first lady join the astronaut corps?
Well, the first group that included female astronauts was, I think, and if I recall correctly, 1978.
That sounds about right.
I'm going to have to double check that. So
That would be 18 years after she qualified for a system that was three systems beyond what she qualified, because that was for the class for space shuttles.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was for space shuttles.
It was for the space shuttles. Yes, yes. Well, we've talked about the Mercury 13 in the past, but for some of our maybe our newer listeners who aren't familiar with that, it was a group of women who really went through the same training, the same testing.
Not training.
The same testing, I guess.
Physical exams.
The physical exams, right. As their what would become the Mercury 7. And they actually progressed pretty far through that process. And then they had the rug basically pulled out from underneath them, and it was shut down. But I understand Wally did pretty well in some of these tests, particularly with the deprivation tank.
Yeah. There were actually three phases to the testing. The first was the physical exams, which were done at the Loveless Clinic in Albuquerque. And those were the ones that all 19 women went through those exams, and 13 of them passed with no physical reservations. And then there were two other phases that, besides some interviews, that the male astronaut candidates went through, of psychological testing and physical stress testing and some other things. Jerry Cobb was the only one of the women who pretty much went through all three phases of testing. By the time the other 18 were tested, they were scheduled to go for one of the other phases at Pensacola Air Station, Naval Air Station. And a matter of 2 or 3 days before they were to leave to go for that testing, they were told that it was canceled because someone at the Naval Air Station contacted NASA and said, "Are you going to pay for this?" And NASA said, "Pay for what?" So that was pulled out from under them. But what Wally did was Jerry Cobb arranged for Wally and one of the other women to go through the psychological test phase. They did that in Oklahoma City. And then after that, Wally, on her own, managed to set up some additional tests that were similar to what many of the tests that the men candidates had done. So she pursued it in some ways farther than any of the others did. Jerry pursued it farther, but then she was the first one. She did many of these things before the other women were even tested at the Loveless Clinic. So things got tougher after that.
And how did Wally feel after being excited and enthusiastic about, you know, the possibilities, and then to have it taken away?
Well, it was a letdown for sure, but she doesn't dwell on anything that's negative. So she basically, it was a disappointment. She essentially threw it a fish and decided that she was going to find her own way to go into space. And she's still trying.
Yeah.
After 60 years, she's still trying.
Right. We'll come to that. Yes. So, what did she do after that experience?
That was only a year or so after she had graduated from college, and essentially right after she finished the first year of being a flight instructor at Fort Sill. And then after that, she went to work as a flight instructor and chief pilot at a general aviation airport in Hawthorne, California. She worked there for a couple of years, I think. And then she decided that before her career tied her down too much, she wanted to see the world. So she and a friend, purchased from afar a VW camper. She and her friend flew to Brussels, picked up the camper, and spent the next 2.5 years touring through Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. So they had some amazing adventures there. And then they came home, and she toured around the United States for a little while after that. And interestingly enough, shortly after she got back to this country and she started traveling, she went down the Atlantic coast, and she happened to be at Cape Canaveral at the time that they launched one of the early unmanned Apollo test flights. And so she saw that from a distance and photographed it. And then after that, she ended up back at Hawthorne working as a chief pilot again until she joined the FAA and then had her career with them and then the NTSB and continued after that with being a chief pilot at various airports.
She has a lot of hours. Rob, how many hours do you have?
19,600. At a few.
How about you, Rob?
Not that many.
Are you going to tell us?
Why don't you ask Max?
All right, Max West. Oh, what are you up to?
Somewhere between 10,000 and 11,000.
That's pretty good.
One of Wally's acquaintances said about her that Wally flies like other people breathe.
Interesting.
She just loves flying.
You know, it's interesting when you think, what was the year she was 21?
Well, she did the testing in February of 1961, which she had actually just turned 22 a couple of weeks before she showed up for the testing.
Well, it's amazing considering how gender-centric everything was then. It's amazing they even thought to involve a group of women as potential astronauts.
Well, that was the doing of Dr. Randy Lovelace, who had designed the physical exams for the astronaut candidates. He and his clinic had actually been doing some testing for the Air Force for their ultra-high flying pilots, like the U-2 pilots, prior to that. And so they were chosen to do the Mercury astronaut testing. And after he had finished testing the men, Dr. Lovelace decided that there might be some real advantages to having women as astronauts because, generally speaking, they're smaller than men, so they take up less space in that small capsule. They generally weigh less than men, so that saves on fuel for liftoff. They need less food and oxygen than men, so again, that's a weight savings for the spacecraft. They tend to tolerate isolation and confinement better than men do and some other things. So fewer heart attacks and various reasons that he thought they might make very good candidates. And so it was really he and General Flickinger from the Air Force that decided to test women.
As demonstrated by all of your co-hosts here during COVID in isolation and not doing mentally well.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, she was very polite and she didn't say, and women are smarter than men. So thank you very much, Loretta.
You're welcome.
Yeah, well, that was kind of you.
Right. Yeah, I think I recall she was in the sensory deprivation tank for like 10 and a half hours, something like that.
10 hours and 35 minutes.
Right.
And at that, they told her, you might as well come on out. She didn't ask to stop the test at that point. She'd have been happy to go on longer.
I think that was some kind of a record, I think.
It was.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, Jerry Cobb, Wally, and Rhea Hurley were the only women that had been tested in the tank up to that point. This was not the same as the isolation test that the male astronauts took. They sat in a dark room for 3 hours.
Oh.
But this was a project by a psychologist at in Oklahoma City, and he had been developing this isolation tank procedure for a while, and that's where Jerry went for her testing, and then she brought the other two in. So I think they were the only first women who had been tested at that, and Jerry stayed in for, I think, 9 hours and 40 minutes, which was a very long time, and then Reyes was in for 10 hours and 30 minutes, I think, and then Wally for 10 hours and 35 minutes.
That's incredible.
I mean, my wife is a psychologist too, and please don't tell her anything about the sensory deprivation tank.
She might stick you in there.
Well, she might. I
know I would never last in that.
Look on the bright side, Rob. You sit in the dark and mumble to yourself for 3 or plus hours a night. So,
but
you
I
should
have
probably
me to talk to. Yes, but I answer me, and I give myself very, very good answers.
Yeah, and this was total sensory deprivation. The water. She had 2 days of psychological testing before she went in the tank. And during that time, about every 2 hours, they were taking her temperature. And she would ask them why. And they said, oh, you'll find out eventually. And then when she got in the tank of water, which was, you know, in a room by itself, totally dark in the room, soundproofed room, there was no air movement that you could feel. She said soon after she got in the tank, she thought that something's weird here, and she started kind of slapping the water a little bit, and she could not feel the water because they had made the air in the room and the water itself exactly her average body temperature. And the humidity in the room was such that water didn't evaporate and create a cooling effect. So she literally had no sense of touch, taste, smell, hearing, sight, anything.
Hmm. For over 10 hours.
Yeah. And apparently some of the subjects that Dr. Shirley had tested previous to that had actually gone into hallucinations after a few hours in the tank. It was a severe test.
I can imagine some young parents would be thrilled to go into that test. Yeah. Get me away from all this noise.
Yeah. For about 15 minutes.
Yeah. Not for 10
That's
hours.
All they're asking. Just 15 minutes. Well, tell us about her being a truly breaking the glass ceiling at the NTSB.
Well, that was both that and the FAA were things that she did not apply for. They were things that people basically invited her into both of those positions. And especially with the NTSB, when they offered her that job, she said, I don't have the kind of knowledge that you people need. And they said, we'll train you. So
why were they attracted to her? Was it because of her reputation or?
Yeah. She had gotten to know some people at the FAA because of being a chief pilot and flight instructor there in Hawthorne. And at one point she decided she's kind of an unconventional person, as you might know, might guess. Yeah. She decided she wanted to go to Alaska and become a bush pilot. But she needed some letters of recommendation. So she contacted a friend of hers, whose husband, I think, worked at the FAA, and asked for a letter of recommendation. And he called her up and he said, Wally, why don't you come into my office on Monday? So she went in and they chatted for a little while. And he said, why don't you come to work for us? Hmm. And then she was with them for, I think, about 4 years. And, she had had some interaction in the meantime with some of the NTSB folks at various accident scenes. And the reports that she filed on the things she investigated for FAA were forwarded to NTSB. And so they were familiar with her work. And so after about 4 years of that, they called her up and said, you want to come work for us?
Hmm. Did Wally have lifelong friends or other friends that supported her in all these activities and things? I can see how someone who does so many different kinds of things, it can sometimes be hard to sort of maintain the same base of friends when you're moving around doing all these different things. So what was the case with her?
Well, she's a very people-oriented person, and she did have good friends, and she would keep in touch with them. And she especially got a lot of support from her mother. Her mother, as a teenager, had had an opportunity to go, a crop duster-type biplane pilot had landed in a field near her school, and all the kids ran out and she wanted to go for a ride. And he said, well, it's a dollar a minute. So she went around, borrowed a dollar from 10 friends, and she went up for 10 minutes. And then she went home and told her dad that she wanted to be a pilot. And her dad said, no, absolutely not. You are a young lady and you will not be a pilot. So when Wally came along and was interested in flying, her mother was behind her all the way. And she ended up taking her mother on some of the air races and even few of the NTSB accident investigations. they were very close.
Yeah, I'm sure the support of her mother really played a big part in, you know, what she would become and what she would do. How about her relationship with student pilots? Because you mentioned she has over 19,000 flight hours. I see that she soloed just hundreds and hundreds of pilots. And I get the impression that she must have loved teaching. Did she?
Mm-hmm. She did. She loves flying so much that the greatest joy she gets, I think, is teaching other people to fly, and especially young people who will have a lot of time in their lives to fly. And in fact, there was one year when she was, I think it was even around the time that she worked for the FAA, that a school in Southern California that had an aviation program had their instructor go on leave for a year, and Wally actually taught the high school aviation program for a year. She loved teaching the kids.
In terms of capturing Wally's biography, her memoir, how did that come about? Was that her idea or your idea or somebody else's?
It was a combination of things. I of course, knew about Wally for a long time. I, being a person who writes about space history, I knew that aspect of her. And then I think about 4 years ago, I was giving a presentation at a Women in Aviation International conference. And my talk was about women space pioneers from New Mexico. And I standing up there in the front of the room getting ready for my presentation, and in walks Wally Funk. She's quite recognizable. And so I said, okay, here we go. When I got partway through my talk, and then I got to a point where I said, okay, I'm going to talk about someone now named Wally Funk, and Wally's sitting right there. So Wally, if I say something that's not true about you, let me know. Yeah. And so she did comment a couple of times during my presentation. And then after my talk was over, she came up, gave me a big hug, and we became friends immediately. So maybe a year or so later, we were visiting each other, and I kept telling her, Wally, you've got to write your book. You've just got to write your memoir. And she just kind of push it off. And then finally she said, will you write it for me? Ah. So I contained my enthusiasm and said, I guess so.
So you must have just a huge number of stories. How did you capture? Did you take notes or did you record them? How did you do that?
I recorded all of our conversation, most of our conversations.
Yeah. So you must have hours and hours and hours of just amazing. Did you fit it all into the book?
Most of the good parts. There were a few things she didn't want to talk about. But yeah, for the most part, I got most of the good stuff in there.
Was there anything that kind of surprised you?
Well, you know, as I said, I was familiar with her space connection, but until I met her and really started interviewing her for the book, I had not realized all of the accomplishments that she had done in the field of aviation or any of the other things like exploring. Going camping for 2.5 years across the ocean, you know. So, yeah, there were a lot of things that surprised me about her.
She liked zip lining?
Oh, she loves it. She still goes zip lining once a year.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't got the nerve yet to do that.
I haven't either.
Yeah, I just.
Oh, come on, Max. Really? Even I've done that.
Have you really?
I would never jump out of an airplane, but I thought zip lining was really cool. Because once you're going, you can't stop. All you can do is look down and keep going. There's no brakes.
I did it in Alaska with my wife. It was great fun.
Yeah.
I've done it both the commercial way and the military way where you just have to hang on.
Yeah.
Wally trained in Star City in the Cosmonaut Center, correct?
She did. She spent a
when
week
was
there.
That?
I believe it was the year 2000. She had a chance to go there for 5 days of astronaut training, and they she said they were it was the real training stuff. That she said sometimes they would finish using a piece of equipment and see there was one of the cosmonauts standing on the side waiting till they finished so he could take his turn. She loved it. It was a great experience for her.
Well, didn't Wally want to become a candidate for the shuttle program? Is that why she was doing that training?
No, this was toward the end of the shuttle program. She had applied to NASA, and there's conflicting statistics on this, either 3 or 4 times back in the 60s and maybe 70s, but kept getting turned down because she didn't have a degree in engineering. So
wasn't she and Jerry Cobb, I believe what Max is referring to is when they went to go say John Glenn back up for a hit, you know, because they had the reason for sending John Glenn was they had a complete bio workup on him from the 60s. And now they were going to see what the effects were later. And I know that, or I believe that Wally and Jerry Cobb replied and said, look, we got the same workup, so we're just as eligible as he is.
Yes, especially Jerry. She became very upset with the whole process. Yeah. Wally would have loved to go. I mean, she's been trying. She worked with, I think, 3 different companies in the probably 1990s and beyond that were preparing for civilian spaceflight. And, you know, none of them panned out. But she's really been trying everything she could think of to get up in space.
So she's been talking to the SpaceX people and
I don't know that she's talked to SpaceX, but she was working with one of the companies that was competing in the Ansari X Prize, and they didn't get their rocket operating before Burt Rutan's team won that. After that, she finally did buy a ticket on Virgin Galactic. So she's waiting her turn.
Yeah. Wasn't she? I think she was one of the early ticket purchasers.
Fairly early. Not unfortunately, not as early as she hopes, because you know, they kind of go by seniority when they of when you bought the ticket, not of age. Yeah.
That would be just amazing, though, if she were able to ride on Virgin Galactic.
She would much rather go into orbit, but...
Sure, sure. Of course.
So what does she do now?
How
does she spend her time?
She's gotten very frustrated during the COVID situation because, as I said, she's very much a people person. And having to just not be out among so many people has been a challenge for her.
And that's understandable. I mean, certainly a lot of us have kind of felt that way.
Yeah.
Hopefully things will be changing in the not too distant future.
For our listeners, if you want to see more of the spirit of Wally Funk and Jerry Cobb, on Apple TV, there's a show called For All Mankind, and it's a fictional NASA history. But starting in season 1, they have a combination character named Molly Cobb, which is a combination of Wally Funk and Jerry Cobb. They combine it into a single character. And the spirit of Wally Funk and Jerry Cobbs is then carried through for the rest of season one and season two. So that's where you can go get inspired by this kind of entrepreneur space, go getting things. And then the other way to learn the more factual thing, Loretta, tell us about your biography of her and where they can get it.
It's called Higher, Faster, Longer, My Life in Aviation and My Career in Spaceflight. I am delighted to say that as of last evening, it was awarded a second place award for biography memoir category in the New Mexico Presswomen's competition. It is available really anywhere. Any bookstore can order it. If you go to wallyfly.com, there's a link there where you can order it from Amazon. It's available in a paperback version and also a Kindle version.
And we'll have some links in the show notes, of course, where you can do that.
It's just such a fascinating story. I really encourage people to read it, not because I wrote it, but because she's just such an amazing person. She's a great role model for positivity, for perseverance. She's just fun to read about. She's done some crazy stuff.
Did she ever make you want to go fly in the space yourself?
I have mixed feelings about it. Sometimes I think I'd like to do it, and sometimes I think I'm not sure, not so sure.
Loretta, just tell us maybe really quickly about the National Space Society and what it means to be a space ambassador.
The National Space Society is, despite its name, actually an international organization that promotes human space exploration and eventually space settlement. And I guess about 2014 or so, they had a space ambassadors program that I heard about because I was a member of NSS. And so I signed up for that. And it basically involves giving talks and that will inform and inspire people to support human exploration of space. And I came in fourth place in that competition. And as a prize, I got to go to the NASTAR Center for 2 days and learn how to fly a simulated Virgin Galactic mission on a centrifuge. So that was really awesome.
Wow.
And then a couple of years later, they decided to do a phase two space ambassadors program. So I'm working on the committee that has been organizing that. So anybody who is interested in promoting the idea of human space exploration, go to nss.org and sign up. We're always looking for new members.
Hey guys, could we recommend Launchpad to go?
I think he's an eager volunteer.
Yeah.
I'll do stories from inside the simulator.
Yeah.
I promise.
Well, unfortunately, space ambassadors don't have that opportunity anymore. So.
Loretta, any future literary works on your part? Any projects that you're working on now?
See that file cabinet back there?
Yes, I see several, actually.
One drawer is full of research for my next book. So... not sure when I'm going to get to it, but because I'm still doing a lot of these kinds of activities to let people know about Wally's story. But it's going to be a book about what human spaceflight is like and what kinds of accommodations human beings have to make when they're traveling for extended periods of time in space.
Hmm.
Psychologically and physically and everything.
I had a conversation with somebody about 20 years ago, maybe, who told me a story about a study or something as to what would be the best psychological makeup of a person who would be in a spacecraft to go to Mars or for extended periods of time. And they told me that one of the best kind of candidates would be prison convicts. Because I don't know if that was true or not.
In some ways, yes.
But that's what they said.
They would be used to confinement. Yeah. I'm not sure they'd be the, you know, the ideal personality to share the cabin with.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was amusing. They were serious, but I don't know. All right. Loretta Hall, thanks so much for telling us a little bit about Wally Funk in the book. And again, we'll have links to a lot of material about this. You have your own website, Loretta. We'll put that in the show notes as well.
Yes, I have a site called authorhall.com.
Very
not,
good.
Not Arthur, but author.
Author, right.
I thought I was so clever picking that name for my website, but it always gets misunderstood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. Loretta, thanks again.
Thank you. This has been so much fun. Thank you all.
Thanks for coming, Loretta.
Our first news item comes from The Motley Fool. This is $30 billion deal could reshape the aviation industry. And what we see is that AerCap Holdings has announced that it would acquire GECAS. That's the unit of General Electric that does aircraft leasing and financing in this $30 billion deal. GECAS, of course, is GE Capital Aviation Services. AerCap is AERCAP. And this basically consolidates the number one and number two commercial aviation financing and leasing companies, at least measured by the number of aircraft. This would make them big. I love the Motley Fool subtitle to this article, which is Boeing's most important customer isn't an airline. It's a leasing company. And now we see leasing, the biggest leasing company, having even more power.
But think about that. Where do they get the – maybe you guys are better at finance than I am, but, of course, the leasing companies have been buying airplanes from the airlines and then leasing them back. So is that essentially how they came up with this $23 billion in added debt?
There's some funny financials going – I don't want to say funny, but, you know, very complex financials going on here. And, like, for instance, one of the things during this purchase, I'd be curious to know how much of their assets are parked in the desert right now under their name versus how many are parked in the desert under their client's name. You know, are the clients still paying lease on airplanes that they're having to park somewhere in the desert?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that number is a closely controlled secret because that shows you what they're really worth.
Well, we do see that as a result of this deal, AerCap takes on a lot of debt and GE takes a 46% equity stake in the company, although GE has the ability to sell off their equity in AerCap, not all at the start. I think there's sort of a phased program. Leasing companies have grown over the years, and like you mentioned, Rob, one aspect of their activity is buying aircraft from airlines and leasing them back to them. That gets that helps the airline's liquidity position, and of course they also, they being the leasing companies, buy new aircraft from the Boeings and the Airbuses and so forth, and then lease those to the airlines. And that's grown a lot over the years. There's some statistics that are reported that indicate that when leasing was kind of getting started in this area in the 70s, less than 2% of the fleet was leased. In 2017, that had grown to 40% of the airliners were under a lease agreement of some sort. And I think this is particularly useful for startups. You know, if you want to start an airline, why buy a lot of airplanes, right? You probably don't have the funding to buy a lot of airplanes, but you can lease airplanes. And, you know, your startup cost is somewhat lessened.
But just think what kind of state the large carriers would have been in over the last year if they had already been leasing airplanes. They would have had no assets to sell to increase their cash flow. And who I I only know how I manage my checking account. And after a while, when there's no cash, you're not liquid.
If you're leasing them, though, depending on the rules of the lease, you may be able to just walk away from it. And therefore, you're not hemorrhaging money because you've walked away from that, from the option you have on that aircraft.
Right. The leasing companies take on some degree of risk, obviously, in leasing aircraft to the airlines. But they have the benefit of consolidated position. So, I mean, one airline in and of itself managing its fleet has a certain level of risk. But if you're a large aircraft lessor, you know, you are combining the risk of multiple airlines.
You know who we need back on this show if you hadn't run him off and had him get a job?
Dan.
Exactly.
Captain Yield Management.
So I tried to do a little bit of research to find out how much these leases generally are. And the best I could find is Aircraft Value News did a report back in 2018. And at least in that year, they found that a 737-8, the monthly lease would run about $385,000 a month. They said an A320neo on a 12-year term might cost $370,000 a month. And then, of course, there's also maintenance reserves associated with this. That's something that a lot of people aren't aware of. But if you're an airline leasing an aircraft, you pay the lessor a maintenance reserve, which is typically a certain number of dollars per flight hour. And you pay that as you go, basically, which the lessor accumulates so that when there is a maintenance required, an engine overhaul or an airframe check or something like that, that the lessor is going to pay for. Well, actually, the lessee pays for it in advance over time. Interesting aspect.
And what you're looking at is, you said $380,000. That's $4.8 million a year times 12 years. That's $56 million to have access to an aircraft that runs, what, new, $80 to $100 million?
Yeah,
the problem being is it's more than that.
And then you don't, the problem being is after 12 years, so you've got no assets.
Well, that's true, but you also don't have to try to sell it.
Right.
Exactly. So, you know, welcome to the Accounting Geeks podcast.
Yeah.
So maybe there's an Airplane Geeks listener somewhere who really understands financing that we can get on here to correct all of the probably inane things that we probably said.
And his first name probably begins with D.
All right. Let's move on. Flying Magazine. Rob, Dassault Falcon 6X makes the first flight.
Well, it was very secret. We all knew it was coming, but for non-business aviation folks, the Dassault 6X is the replacement airplane for the 5X, the design of which came to a grinding halt. Was that 3 or 4 years ago? I can't quite remember, but because there was an engine problem that kind of popped up, and I still remember being at NBAA when the Dassault people put what was the name of the engine? The Silvercrest, I think.
Right.
But the reporters in the audience were asking the people from Dassault, so what's going on? What happened? And I can't think of who it was. Maybe it was Falcon Jet CEO here in the States said, well, actually, I'm not really in a place to answer that. And he pointed to the engine rep in the back of the room and said, why don't you stand up and tell them? And the guy just kind of, sure. And you could tell he was not ready for that question at
all.
Please
stand here up next to the curb so I can throw you under the bus.
Really? I felt so bad for that fellow. And that was a story unto itself. But anyway, not long after that, Dassault canceled the 5X project and came up with the 6X. New, boy, I should know the engines. Max, are these Pratt?
Yep, Pratt & Whitney Canada PW800 series. This one is specifically the PW812D, which is an interesting engine. It's the core of a geared turbofan that would be used on a Mitsubishi MRJ without the geared fan. So it's the core of that engine. It also powers, I think, the Gulfstream or that series, the Gulfstream G500 and G600 as well. Although on that's a larger engine, and that's a PW814 and 815, and that's also the core of a geared turbo, a GTF geared turbofan engine, but it's the one that powers the Airbus A220, whereas the smaller one, as I said, is for the MRJ.
Well, I think the real story, of course, beside the fact that the 6X is a wide-body business airplane, is the fact that Dassault was able to pull this off so relatively quickly. I mean, and look at the MRJ story, and that, you know, how many years that went on before it was canceled. So again, people really thought at first that Dassault was just going to kind of cave in on that, but I think they've shown the world they're still there, and so we don't have a whole lot of details about the first flight, except that it was successful, of course, and the story is yet to be told.
Well, another aspect of this is that the flight was dedicated to Olivier Dassault, who died in a helicopter accident March 7th recently. He was the grandson of Marcel Dassault, and he was an Air Force Academy graduate, combat engineering officer and pilot, and he was a reserve member in the French Air Force. But interesting guy. He had a passion for photography. He published several books of photographs. He was also a composer and a musician, and he held a number of world speed records, actually. New York to Paris and a Falcon 50. That was back in the 70s. But he also held speed records in the Falcon 900 and the 900EX. That was the Paris to Dubai run in 1996. So an interesting guy. As I said, died in a helicopter accident along with the pilot. Those were the only two occupants of the helicopter. And I don't know anything more about that accident or what are the circumstances surrounding
it. No, nor do I. I just know that I heard about it, and that really is it.
All right, another story from Flying Magazine. 2021 GA Award winners announced by FAA committee. Now, there's a story behind this story. Max Trescott knows what that is. So two episodes ago, we messed up, and nobody caught us. I kept waiting for somebody to say, hey, you guys screwed up, because we reported on the winners, the flight instructor of the year, the aviation technician, and all of that, and we said who the winners were and everything. Well, the article that I picked up on was last year's winners. Those were the 2020 winners, not the new 2021 winners.
I wasn't on that show. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
And, you know, it was an easy mistake to make, because I think in the same show we were talking about the 2020 Collier Trophy.
Right.
And, of course, those trophies are for the prior year. And so I think when you picked up this, you looked for the 2020 awards, and yet these are listed for the current year. So you have similar awards occurring at the similar time, but with different years.
Right.
So the standard is a little different between the two, so it was easy to get confused. I remember you asked me to start with a story, and I said, I can't find one of the names here. And then you went ahead and read the story. And part of the disconnect was I was looking at different set of names and I couldn't find one of them. And then you went with the other story, and I didn't pick up on the fact that the names were different at that time. So somehow we ended up with two sets of links, and one of them was wrong.
Yeah, and we figured it out.
Hey, Launchpad, doesn't it sound like an awful lot of backpedaling here?
It is.
It does. I mean, you know, geez, maybe they should have had, you know, a qualified aviation journalist like yourself on for, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Where's those interns for fact checking? Yeah.
So, Rob, tell us who the 2021 award winners are.
Let's get to that. I mean, I was just going to say, why don't all these associations get their act together and either decide they're all going to do this year's award for last year, or they're going to, you know, anyway. So let's see, National Flight Instructor of the Year, a role Max Trescott knows quite a bit about. He was the Instructor of the Year in 2008, I believe, Max.
And that's when you and I met, was I think, the award ceremony.
Or was that 1908?
Yeah, that was Wilbur's.
I can never get that right. Yeah, boy, that was a long
Wilbur
time
was
ago.
There for that one.
But this year it was Ronald J. Timmermans of Orlando, Florida, and Michael Colin Dunkley of Coshocton? Maybe a Coshocton, Ohio resident will ring in or email us and tell everybody how I butchered that name. But he's the maintenance technician of the year. And Adam Timothy. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I would say if you were smart, you just said a suburb of Cleveland and then move on.
Well, right. If I had been intelligent enough to even know that was a suburb of Cleveland. But it is now, I'm afraid. It is now of Cleveland. And Adam Timothy McGee of Swisher, Iowa, as the FAA safety team representative of the year. And I mean, I think that's something that we often don't spend a lot of time with because we only hear about these things once a year. But these people have some incredible amounts of experience or incredible kinds of experience. And if you meet one up at Oshkosh this year, you know, give them a pat on the back. Except I'm wondering, there were no ladies in this, or am I supposed to say women? There are no women in this group, though, are there? Were there last year?
Mm.
There were, yes, last year there were.
Okay.
And as you said, the awards are presented at AirVenture at Oshkosh in July, assuming that event goes forward as planned.
Well, congratulations to all these winners.
Next story is, this is a fun one. This is, where is this from? WFAA, which is...
it's Dallas TV.
Dallas. And our historian, I believe, Dave Vanderhoof brought us to our attention. And the story is, to infinity and beyond! Southwest Airlines.
Go ahead.
Actually, I brought it.
Oh, did you?
I did, yep. But this is a fantastic story. This is our positive airline story of the week. And, you know, it's, you read things like this and it's so so heartwarming. But, you know, Launchpad there was giving the signature line from Buzz Lightyear to infinity and beyond. And as you might have guessed, some poor young toddler left his Buzz Lightyear on the aircraft when they got off the plane at Dallas Love Field. And, of course, when the parents got to the rental car location, they realized, oops, we're missing Buzz. And they had to tell their young son that Buzz was off on a mission. And lucky for them, he completed the mission and found his way back to them because a ramp agent for Southwest found him on the airplane. And he looked Buzz over and he found that on the bottom of Buzz's boot was the family's last name, Hagen. And he checked the flight and they found there was just one Hagen family that had flown on that aircraft that day. But rather than just contact the family and send it back, he had a little fun. He took Buzz around the airport, took all kinds of pictures. There's a great picture of Buzz standing on the ramp with a Southwest jet behind him. And the camera angle is shot from 1 inch off the deck. So Buzz is taller than the camera, and you've got the Southwest jet in the background.
And he's in that heroic pose.
Yep. Yeah, he looks great. And then this ramp agent went ahead to write a custom letter which was hand-lettered in kind of an interesting-looking font, and it was addressed to the young boy. It says, "To Commander Hagen, I'm very excited to return to you upon completing my mission. I was able to explore the airport and spaceport in Little Rock, Arkansas, while I was away, and I have included photos of my adventure. My journey was, trust me, something a lot, but I'm so thankful to return to my buddy, to infinity and beyond, your buddy, Buzz Lightyear Space Ranger." And so the family, I think, was totally blown away when this box arrived, and they posted a video of it, and you can see the little boy there as Buzz is being pulled out of the box. So talk about a positive airline story. I just absolutely love this story.
I love it too. And what's really good for Southwest is that Buzz made another additional leg before they discovered Buzz. It wasn't when they were cleaning the airplane there, because they got off in, what, Dallas, and then the plane went on for another leg, and Buzz was discovered in Little Rock. So, you know, attaboy to Southwest.
Yeah, that's a great story, and especially the letter from Buzz, you know, talking about his mission. That's just and there's video of this that shows the little boy's reaction when they open up the box, and there's Buzz Lightyear in there. It's just precious.
The photos are fantastic. Well, and
you know, that's the kind of PR that you can't buy.
Right.
I mean, if they'd cook this up, people would have said, whatever. But I mean, nobody at Southwest Airlines told this agent to do this. He took it upon himself to, you know, research getting the Buzz Lightyear back to the guy, but thought, hey, you know what? Let's have a little fun with it while we're at it. And although I haven't traveled on Southwest or any airline in a year, I remember that the Southwest people were always good for things like that. And thank goodness they're still at it.
It's part of the corporate culture, you know, that you create. And some big companies value a culture that just automatically leads to people doing kind things like that. And others just, they don't prioritize it. And so maybe it'll happen sometimes, depending on the individual. And a lot of times it doesn't happen. But to me, it's part of the corporate culture that you build, which is not an easy thing to do. But I think Southwest has got it. Another interesting kind of fun story, serial stowaway. I didn't know that there was a serial stowaway. Whose story is this?
This is mine, and this is actually in Rob's backyard. Rob, you probably remember about the woman who has been getting on airplanes without paying for tickets, and I think we all knew that she had done this a couple of times, but this was really quite shocking. She was interviewed by CBS2 in Chicago, and she revealed that she'd actually done this 30 times. So you gotta sit there and wonder, how does anybody jump the security line 30 times and get onto an airplane without a boarding pass?
Yes.
And that's probably the mind-boggling thing about this, because, you know, if this doesn't kind of raise all kinds of red flags where you're thinking, what if a terrorist were to do that? But she was very upfront about her little scheme, which probably would be a little hard for terrorists to duplicate. They would first have to look like a little old grandmother, which she is. But she said, quote, "I got by them. This is the thing that is so crazy. By following someone that would be carrying like a blue bag," she said. "And the next thing I know, I get into the TSA line, and TSA lets me through, and they think I'm with the guy with the blue bag." Just as a security expert Jeff Price says, for her to be able to repeat that over and over and over is just mind-boggling.
I just stumbled onto the story when you posted it and went and watched it and read. This represents a triple failure, though, because at the security level, we've got her getting past TSA, but then she's getting past the gate agent to board the airplane. And then the third one is, when she gets on the airplane, how is the purser not catching the fact that she's having to bump, you know, that someone else comes, hey, there's somebody in my seat. You know, so the purser should be checking the seat, you know, count as they're going through. And if they have a wrong seat count, it's like, wait, who are we missing? Or who's, you know, wait, we got one more than we should. So this, and which is why in the audio, all the airlines went, no comment, because
yeah.
They're,
it
and the
bad.
Other thing being is that on some of those flights are international flights. And by agreement, when you get to the foreign country, if you're not a legal, as in don't have a passport, don't have a visa, it's by treaty, the airline that brought you there has to haul you home at their expense, which is why when you board an international flight, they all want to see a passport and make sure the passport lines up with the boarding pass, because if it doesn't, they're on the hook to send you back. So it's like, oh man, we've three different layers failed here.
And over 30 times.
Yeah, it looks like she went to London twice and went to somewhere else in Europe, and they've got a full list of all the places she's been in the U.S. And to think that she's only been arrested a couple of times. And the judge, of course, has just had it with her. He's basically said, all right, this is the last free pass that she gets. I think she's been in court twice.
Yeah, that's what they said last time. I remember this happening, and they said, this is over, except it's not. But I what a great disguise. I mean, back in, I don't know, whenever that movie, remember the original Airport movie? And the actress Helen Hayes played the kind of grandmotherly old woman who kind of snuck on the airplane and got herself a seat. And they were going to kick her off. And she became instrumental in saving the airplane. But that was another story. But 30 times security failed, and I'm sure there are people out there at TSA that are saying, oh, the stories we could tell you.
Well, they've got a picture posted, so apparently everybody knows this is one of the most wanted, be on the lookout type of characters.
So I have a different viewpoint of this, and that is, if you go back to the old original definition of hacker, which is not a negative term initially, but refers to somebody who takes things apart, probes things in order to learn how they work and to see what they can do. And if there are vulnerabilities, they're exposed. This woman is a hacker in the purest original sense. And she's not the one who's at fault.
Oh, you're right.
She's not the one. She should not be penalized in my opinion. I know it's kind of a little bit offbeat, but she should not be penalized for doing this, because all she did was expose the Launchpad said, the failures of others or the failures of other systems. So that's good. I mean, I think it's good that we know that she could get away with this, because, what's the implications for terrorists and things? She's exposed a vulnerability in the system, and she shouldn't be penalized for that. And if anybody else can find any other vulnerabilities in the system, I think we want to know about them. So that's my take.
And we should mention that she has admitted that she's had some mental health issues.
Yeah,
she said that I'm bipolar, and this is something I've rejected for years. She does say that she's now going to make sure she doesn't do this again. But interesting thing, in one phone conversation from jail, she was asked if she felt a fight or flight response. And yeah, she literally took a flight.
Yeah, she did. Okay. We'll have a couple of other quick stories in the show notes. One is from Connected Aviation Today. This is Women's History Month, a look at impactful women in aviation. And then AOPA also published a piece, Women Entrepreneurs in Aviation. And there's a number of women highlighted in both of those articles.
Or you could just buy Loretta's book.
Well, Loretta has brought us another one. But there's some interesting stories of different types. Leanne Ridgway joined Rockwell in 1988 as a temporary hire. Well, she's now in a senior leadership role at Rockwell Collins, which of course now is Collins Aerospace. She worked herself up the ladder. And there are a number of others. Joan Higginbotham. I always loved that name, Higginbotham. She joined Kennedy Space Center. She was eventually selected as an astronaut candidate by NASA in 1996. She helped build the International Space Station. She's got 308 hours in space. She was one of the folks that operated the space station remote manipulator system, also called the robot arm on the space station. And she's also one of only three African-American women in history to go to space. So there are a number of kind of inspirational stories in those two articles. Certainly if you have children or other people that could benefit from, you know, seeing these positive experiences from these amazing women, that, you know, it'd be a good idea to share those with them. And actually, one final thing, Rob, the birthday boy, the recent birthday boy, but you're not alone in having a birthday.
No, in fact, within just a few days of my birthday, the former astronaut Frank Borman had a birthday, and he's slightly older than me.
That's in dispute. But he was,
and thank you for that, audience member, whoever you are out there. And thank you, Max West, for not commenting. That's an inside joke.
We're brothers. I never tell on my brother.
I had a chance to interview him, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago for Aviation International News. I'll be darned if I remember what the story was about, but he was just the nicest guy to sit and have lunch with. But Frank was an original Gemini 7 commander, and he also flew on Apollo 8. He was an Air Force test pilot. And, of course, as he is better known to many people, he was the CEO of Eastern Airlines, a name that has, you know, kind of evaporated into history. That was many moons ago that Eastern went under. In fact, come to think of it, I think they went under around the same time that Midway did for me, so maybe the early 90s. Oh, my gosh, I just dated myself, didn't I? Well, doesn't matter now. Anyway, Frank Borman is 93. Happy birthday, Frank.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy birthday. And same to you, Rob.
Thank you. Thank you. 50 is it's a good age.
Yeah, all right.
You wear it well.
All right. What's up with the geeks? A couple of things. I just recorded an episode of the PaxX podcast with Mary Kirby. We talk about some interesting topics. One is the IATA poll on traveler expectations, which polled they based their study on an arrival poll and a departure poll, and they asked a number of questions about people's travel thoughts in this sort of COVID pandemic world. So we talk about that. We also talk about Cathay Pacific. They're talking about not requiring passengers in lie flat cabins to wear a mask while sleeping. So we talk about that a little bit. We can understand maybe how some people would think that was kind of elitist or something. So we talk about that.
It's mythical because I can tell you, I have never been able to lie flat or seen anybody lie flat in an airplane. It's one of those in the cloud myth, you know, like unicorns and, you know, nobody gets to sleep lying horizontal.
Rainbows and unicorns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on an airplane.
And we also talk about green aviation, some of the technologies that are being developed and what the outlook is for them. How does supersonic flight fit in with those two? So that's the PaxX podcast. That's episode 74. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. And I just wanted to mention real quick, you know, I've mentioned that I have this, it's really a vanity page, but 30,000feet.com. And I still have the directory of aviation podcasts in there. And a lot of people have been looking at that lately and, in fact, providing me with some omissions, some podcasts that weren't in the directory that need to. But because so many people are using it and because it's so easy these days, in like a course of about 10 minutes, I bought aviationpodcastdirectory.com, and it just redirects to the to my little directory, aviationpodcastdirectory.com. If you're interested in seeing several dozens of aviation podcasts that are out there.
Well, that's the motivation that originally got you into this, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. The old 30,000 feet directory got me into that. That's gone except for the aviation podcasts.
When did you put that up first, Max?
1996.
Wow.
Yeah, the early days of the worldwide. You know, the reason I did that was because I wanted to figure, it's hacking. It's hacking. I wanted to figure out, how does this World Wide Web thing work? So I said, well, the only way to do that is to make a web page. And I needed to, you know, if you're going to make a web page, you got to have a topic. So I said, well, you know, it's kind of, this is pre-Google and, you know, search engines. There were a few around, but they weren't very good. It was hard to find aviation resources, websites on the web. So I'd gotten pretty handy at that. It started out as this, you know, one page that was apparently so impressive that I was a USA Today site of the day or site of the week or something like that, which drove a lot of traffic to me. But
woo-hoo!
Yeah, but I kept going and going and going, and I ended up with something like 20,000 aviation links in there, all categorized.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, which was.
So the Airplane Geeks has its own Energizer Bunny.
Those are the days. You recall, we didn't Google things there. It was AltaVista, and we used the Netscape browser.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And the young folks listening are going, what are those old guys talking
about? I know. So aviationpodcastdirectory.com. All right. Max Trescott, what's up with you these days?
Well, I was a guest on the Airline Pilot Guy podcast this week, so episode 463. Had great fun with the crew over there, Captain Jeff, Dr. Steph, and Captain Nick. Miami Rick was not on. He was had something else going on at that point. So that was great fun. I mean, what a warm group of funny people.
Yes.
I mean, it was they are you know, very welcoming and are just hilarious. So I encourage folks to go on over and take a listen to it if you haven't heard the Airline Pilot Guy podcast. They, of course, focus pretty much on the airlines. Though Dr. Steph is a GA pilot, so that brings in some of the GA aspect of it as well. And by the way, while I was there, I mentioned one thing that I had learned from their prior episode, which was that Micah, who we all know, had been on Leo Laporte's TWIT podcast this week, a technology podcast. And apparently he's been on a number of times in the past. And so whenever Micah goes on the show, he mentions this podcast and the Airline Pilot Guy
podcast.
Which is cool. And Leo seems to think that those are his podcasts. and so when I first joined the Airline Pilot Guy, no, of course not.
But did Micah try to change his mind? Ah, well, probably not.
No, of course not.
I don't think anybody can change Leo Laporte's mind.
Well, but you can also understand how, you know, Leo has so many things going on that he might not catch that little subtlety. But I was joking with the folks on the Airline Pilot Guy that I work on Micah's other podcast, the Airplane Geeks podcast. So that was – we had fun joking about the two of us, you know, all of us being working for Micah on his two podcasts.
Yeah, that's great. That's funny.
And that you wanted a raise.
Yeah, those guys are great. I love those guys. Airline Pilot Guy. All right, let's see. Rob, what do you have going on these days, aviation-wise?
Well, since we're all mentioning who was where and other people involved, I mean, the Fullerton Airport Pilots Association out there in the West Coast in California, where the sun never sets, heard me on one of Max's episodes and Aviation News Talk, and invited me to give a presentation tomorrow night about we're talking about VFR flight into IMC conditions as an FAA safety seminar. So thank you, Captain Max, for well, actually, you didn't say anything good about me. You just let me blab, and they thought, that'll work. So, but I'm looking forward to it. It sounds like a really another good bunch of people.
So they're going to do a Zoom meeting or something like that?
Yes. Yeah, good. Yeah, you know, see, I could have had a Buzz Lightyear. That would have been a great intro. But now it would seem like I'd taken it from somewhere.
Okay. All right, Launchpad Marzari, what's going on with you?
Oh, it's a full week coming up. This Saturday, I've been asked to bring the Focke-Wulf out to the Blue Bonnet Air Show in Burnett, Texas.
Mm.
And I'll see if I can get some reports there from some of the other. This is kind of pre-show, or I should say, because traditionally Sun and Fun is the start of the air show season, a little one-day show. Then I want to remind all our listeners that our plane tags giveaway is still going on. Go to motoart.com or planetags.com. Get us a screenshot or the web address of your favorite piece of furniture, which tag, mail it to us at the geeks at theairplanegeeks.com and tell us which of the four keychains you want or luggage tags, because we're giving away four of them. And, oh, by the way, I looked them up. The combined value of those things is over $300 that we're giving away of those plane tags. So it's a pretty cool deal. So again, send your entry to the geeks at theairplanegeeks.com.
Close. Close. The geeks at airplanegeeks.com.
Oh, sorry.
But you were pretty close.
Also, while you're there at planetags.com, we've got a discount code for you. If you don't feel lucky enough to win one, you can buy one. There's a 15% off discount code by typing the word airplane geeks at checkout. We want to thank Plane Tags for letting us have a discount code. And that's repeated also in our Slack page. Oh, there's Slack. Hey, if you want to continue the conversation, you should send us a notice to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com to get an invite to join the Slack. That's where we have discussion groups, and also the conversation keeps going. It's a closed garden, so you don't have to worry about advertising or any of that other stuff. And including, we're starting up an F1 fantasy league in the random section, because F1's coming out and it's going to be pretty good. And in fact, the winner this year, again, will get a set of German chocolate bars smuggled from Germany. And the last thing, as we mentioned earlier, from Sun and Fun, the Airplane Geeks will be live Wednesday, April 14th, 1800 hours on Sun and Fun Radio and repeated on liveatc.net. If you're at Sun and Fun, stop by and see us. We want to see what your face looks like. You can see what the voices in our head looks like. I'll be the handsome one. Rob will be the real old one.
Are you going, Rob?
I'm not confirmed yet. It's flying still hasn't made a decision about what's going to happen. So it's anybody's guess.
Probably Nancy would, you know, sign you a note for a mental health visit, a little getaway.
Right now, after having been cooped up for 6 weeks, I don't believe she would let me go anywhere warm without her.
Oh, good. Yeah, she's a smart lady.
So now we're bringing both.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Plus, I'm going to bring some Airplane Geeks T-shirts down there. So that'd be another motivation to search us out at the radio station.
Are they the fresh ones this time, or are you going to give away used ones like you did?
No, these are fresh
ones. A couple of years ago.
And you know what? Well, what's different this time, Rob, from the last time I saw you down there, is I got some 2X T-shirts. Last time, extra large was the largest I had. And turns out that a lot of aviators won't fit into an XL T-shirt. So we have some 2X T-shirts now. So look for us.
And I'll have German chocolate to anybody who comes up and finds me in the crowd or listen to them, and we'll give you some smuggled German chocolate.
Can you say that on live radio? I mean, aren't you afraid the feds will come and get you?
Hey, if you can sneak onto an airplane for nothing.
Open the door. It's the cops.
Yeah.
Come out with your hands up.
All right. Hey, we've got a shout out. We heard from Andrea, and she made us aware of something, a film, a hybrid documentary and action film. It's called Journey to Royal, a World War II rescue mission. And this is it's an interesting story. It's a historical story. And one of the things that makes this sort of unique is that it was filmed using real planes from the Palm Springs Air Museum and the Marchfield Air Museum, as well as some recreated models. But it's available now. You can stream it. It's on some cable platforms, DVD, if you do that. But it's a story that takes place during the Second World War. It's about the 4th Emergency Rescue Squadron, and they were stationed in the South Pacific. And those crews policed flight paths searching for B-29 bombers and downed airmen and all of that, folks who needed rescue in the open ocean. And so they really took a lot of effort to be historically accurate. The producer said she says, we recreated rafts and Mae West life vests. We hand-sewed costumes and made props. Everything in this film is historically accurate. So we'll put a link in the show notes to the trailer. There's also an ABC affiliate story that covers this. The website is journeytoroyal.com. And based on the trailer, it looks awfully interesting. But she also provided some of the statistics from that 4th Emergency Rescue Squadron, and they flew 862 rescue missions, 6,000 hours of flying time. They had 89 direct rescues, 487 assisted rescues, so it's a total of 576 lives that were saved, which is just phenomenal. So check it out. Details in the show notes. Thanks for passing that along to us, Andrea.
Yeah, and just think about 576 lives and how many grandchildren are now here that wouldn't have been if these people hadn't been rescued. Thousands and thousands.
Right, exactly. Last episode, we gave Micah some homework. We gave him a homework assignment because we had talked about the ACI Awards, the Airports Council International Awards, and how the Jetport in Portland had been one of the airports receiving those awards, but we weren't able to find the list of all the award winners. So Micah talked to Paul Bradbury at the Jetport, and Micah says he got back to him within 10 minutes. There's customer service for you, he says. But he passed along the link to the World's Best Airports for Customer Experience. And so we'll put that in the show notes. So thanks, Micah, for digging that out. Thanks, Paul, for supporting us with that information. And it lists worldwide all of the airports in different categories based on size, basically, who won this award from Airports Council International this year. And I think these are the awards for 2020, I think.
Or maybe 2021.
I think these are the 2020 awards.
We could always just say the latest awards.
That's much better.
That covers
us. That's much
better. Hey, and you know what my favorite category is from these awards?
What?
The Best Hygiene Award.
Oh, I know.
Which
cleanest airport, I guess, right?
Yeah, I suppose. But just to let you know, here in the United States, it was apparently a tie because they've got Atlanta, New Orleans, San Antonio, Tampa, well, and also Toronto and Victoria. So here in North America, we've got multiple ties for best hygiene. So congratulations.
Yeah, absolutely. Hygiene is everything these days. Oh, dear. All right. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest was Loretta Hall. She captured the memoir of Wally Funk, the amazing Wally Funk, in the book Higher, Faster, Longer, My Life in Aviation and My Quest for Space Flight. And you can learn more about that at wallyfly.com, wallyfly.com. Of course, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. The direct link for the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/645. A couple of quickies. Don't forget our listener poll from episode 643. That's where we ask, who would you like to see win the Collier Trophy? And you can find that poll at airplanegeeks.com/poll643. Who would you like to see win the Collier Trophy? There's a list there, so you just check the one you like best. Don't forget our plane tags drawing that Launchpad mentioned, and because the deadline for that is the end of what month is this? March. So get those to us by the end of March. Put plane tags in the subject field if you would, and again send us a photo or a screen grab of your favorite moto art item or tag, and The actual tags that we're giving away are in episode 643. So you can see a picture there. So if you want, you can list your order of preference should you be selected, and we'll, you know, try to give those four tags out and get as many people their preferred tag as possible. All right. I think that's just about it. Oh, our email again is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Ian Max Trescott, where can we find more of you?
Well, the usual place. You listen to podcasts, so you can certainly find Aviation News Talk at whatever place you go to get podcasts. And if you want to shoot me an email, just go out to aviationnewstalk.com. Click on contact at the top of the page and shoot me an email.
And Launchpad Marzari.
I'm on Facebook as Launchpad Marzari. I'm on Twitter as Pilot Launchpad. And then, of course, here at The Geeks at launchpad@theairplanegeeks.com. And on our Slack listener team, you can be part of it.
Very good. And how about you, Rob Mark?
Certainly at flyingmag.com, at jetwine.com. Let's see, where else? At home a whole lot the last 6 weeks, taking care of an ailing wife who is certainly on the mend, as my friends say in Britain.
Very good. Yeah, we wish her the best. I hope you're taking good care of her, Rob.
She said I have been, and she's going to give me a report card very soon.
All right. Well,
we intend to publish it.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be something?
And both of you, be careful walking on the ice out there.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you're not kidding.
No more slipping. And you can find me at 30,000feet.com, all words. There you can find links to the podcasts, the social media places where I hang out, and all of that. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Night, everybody.
Frequency change approved.